Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Tonight, our speaker will be Travis Marsach. I think all of you know Travis. And the title of his talk is Siblingship, The Ways in Which Class Structures Estrange Us. Welcome, Travis.
Thanks, Bonnie. Good night, everybody. It's really nice to be here tonight. Last fall, I gave a talk on freedom, and I've been thinking about values for the last year or so, thinking about universal human values, or you could say humanistic values that are relatively steady, things that don't vary much with time, and that we aspire to. So where I started was from the triple treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I thought a lot about modernity. Actually, for the last several years, I've been thinking about modernity and what it means to be a practicing Buddhist in the modern world. And then moreover, I've thought about what it's like to be a Buddhist in a democratic society. And I have an interest in history, so I've kind of gone back to the birth of modern democratic societies, which I trace back actually to Europe, in France. So as you know, the French tripartite motto, you probably know, has three values that kind of mesh together, and those are freedom, or liberté, equality, égalité, and fraternity. Those are represented in the tricolor of the French flag, of the French Republic. And, you know, the last time I talked via Zoom, I was talking about sincerity. I think that the distinction I would make between that talk and tonight is that with siblingship, which is really like a gender neutral version of fraternity, I've skipped past equality. I may go back to it at some point. But I struggled with it, to be honest. I knew I couldn't really give a good equality talk. But I hope to creep up on it a little bit tonight, because really they're not so different. Really with equality, where I was struggling was who defines the equality, and how do we exact it in such a way that it helps people. You know, the media that we're able to interact with is changing unbelievably fast. It's the stream of information, just the ability that I could talk to you tonight from up in Calaveras County, and you see my face and you hear my audio, and it's really remarkable. And I can go back to like when I talked about Don Quixote and what that really meant socially for people, because here was a serial of a hero. There's a subscription service people would be reading the next installment. And in Western society in Europe and in the New America, that was a form of practiced empathy. I know that there are several of you who are literary minded, and when you read a novel, you get inside a character, and that person becomes you in a sense, and you think about what it would be like to live a different life. And that's really remarkable. And I want to connect that to what we're doing tonight, which is, it's a different medium. It's a warmer medium. And it's not really a linear medium, because, you know, I can talk to several of you at once, and it's like I'm right here. It's not a crowd. It feels different, but there's like this filter, and you're not really seeing me. You're seeing a visual representation of me. So it's a nonlinear process. It's accelerating. We're trying to cope with it. It's extremely entertaining. It is one of those things where, you know, you have access to every song you've ever, you know, liked. You have accessibility to every movie you ever cared about. You can probably look up your old friends from high school. They haven't lost touch completely because of social media, although I've made a deliberate attempt not to do that. In our Zen tradition, we have this, and this is from Suzuki Roshi, through that lineage, but you know, the one bird with one stone. We actually don't even want to, you know, throw stones at any sentient life, but just to live is to impose on other people. And so I feel a little odd, because I'm up here in you know, a relatively remote place. I don't see anyone except my family. I go out occasionally, but to be with you tonight is pretty special. But something I'm still learning how to feel about. I want to talk a little bit about my background. I grew up in Keokuk, Iowa. And Keokuk, Iowa is a really geographically unique place, because it's at the confluence of two rivers, the Des Moines River and the Mississippi River. There used to be three regions in the Mississippi Valley: the Upper Mississippi, the Middle Mississippi, and the Lower Mississippi. And Keokuk was at the interface between the Upper and the Middle Mississippi. And this goes back to even Native American times. And then the Lower Mississippi is below Memphis. You know, you've got basically the Ohio and the Mississippi come together, and then the river gets very big. It's draining a third of the continent at that point. And it's a really wild river that dumps out in New Orleans. And a couple hundred years ago, that was occupied by French. It was basically like a West Indies colony. And there was, as you probably know, the slave trade. And my last name's Marceau. My family came up through New Orleans in the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, and settled in the St. Louis area. So there's actually like a farm that we had in what is now St. Louis, and then moved up further north into northern Missouri. And you know, even my grandparents, you know, talked with a certain Missouri accent. They would say Missouri, but you know, like I'm trying to think like how to describe it, but it's like if you were listening to Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash, like when he's talking to the prisoners. It's that sort of Mid-South dialect that goes down through Missouri and into Arkansas. And it's a rough place. It's a very, there's a lot of poverty. If you look at the crime statistics in major cities in the United States today, the most dangerous places in the world are on this river. The places where you're most likely to be shot, murdered, raped, carjacked. And I'm talking about St. Louis, Memphis, New Orleans, the places where they keep statistics. But I grew up in a small town. And I grew up in a town where my feature guest tonight, Mark Twain, is from. Not where he was born. He's known for growing up in Hannibal, which is across the river of where my parents live. But his brother owned a printing business in the 1850s. And he lived in Keokuk in my neighborhood in 1855 through 1857. And I'm going to, Bonnie, if you don't mind, I'll share my screen.
Sure, Travis. Give me just a second.
So these are the two pictures I have in my cabin, the two portraits in the foreground you see. Avalokiteshvara, and in the background you have Mark Twain. And this was a portrait that was painted when he was about 20 years old. This is, you know, well before he was a celebrity, or he had sold his first story. He was helping his brother in this printing business, and he was a good typesetter. You know, life might have been, he might have been bored and looking for something more. And he eventually got it, because after he left Keokuk, he went to become a steamboat pilot. You can read Life on the Mississippi. That's a book he wrote much later. But the Civil War interrupted that. And he went west with his brother. And his brother was in he was the Secretary of the Nevada Territory. So he was very close to where I'm at right now. There's stories about him coming out here and, you know, cursing the desert, and which, you know, it's just over the Sierras that it gets very dry and very, very nasty if you're not in air conditioning. The first time he then went up and visited Tahoe, and there was nobody there. There were like 15 people. And he went camping and was roasting trout and set a huge fire and had to leave. His life story reads about like an emergence of the nation itself, and that's the way his celebrity developed. After the war, he spent a short period of time in San Francisco, which was his favorite city. At that time, he wrote the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which got coast-to-coast release in the newspapers. And it was the kind of sensation where people would be like reading it to each other. And it's a very funny essay. If you haven't read it, it's, you know, it's like 10 or 15 pages. You can read it in a short period of time. And remember that Americans were starting to become literate at this point. You know, there was a sort of emergence of this what had been previously maybe a coastal or more elite activity. Or this was something that Europeans did. They read novels. That literary tradition, you know, went back hundreds of years. But, you know, in the Gilded Age, you know, the post Civil War age, like there was this emergence of reading, and so he was a satirist. He was a humorist, but he was sincere and he was honest, and he was the first writer to talk about normal Americans. And when I say normal, I mean, you know, if you're going to have a story about gold prospectors, you're going to do it in the dialect that they speak. And a lot of these are, you know, Appalachian people who came over. They don't have a lot of resources, and they're going for it, and he was going for it. So after that story was a big hit, he went to Hawaii. He came back. He was on the first cruise ship, really like the first commercial cruise liner to Europe from the United States, and he just was having a great time as an entertainer. You could almost imagine him being on the ship as an ex-steamboat captain. He was a prolific partier. At some point in his life, I heard that he was smoking 300 cigars a month, which, you know, you just kind of like get your mind around that. He had a remarkable amount of energy, and his writing output was amazing. I mean, he wrote over 30 novels. He wrote thousands of essays in his life. And so he gets to this point where he's on the ship partying, and he sees his wife. His wife to be, and it's through the locket of this woman's brother, and she's an abolitionist on the East Coast, Olivia is her name, and so she's someone who, they get married, he moves to the East Coast, and he gets into this community. This abolitionist community, and his life evolves. This is about 1870. By 1877, he's written Tom Sawyer. By 1883, he's written Life on the Mississippi. And he's also doing this by subscription service. So it's potentially lucrative. Like, he's controlling the publications, and people who like how he writes are pre-signing up for these books. So he's selling like tens of thousands of copies pre-order. So just to give you a sense of like his level of celebrity and widespread appeal. But I'm going to read to you tonight a section from Huckleberry Finn. And it's what I call the heart of Huckleberry Finn. And, you know, like, one of the top things that Huckleberry Finn is known for is its prolific use of the N-word, which I'm not going to use that word tonight. But this section, it's really simple. I'm just going to take that word out and substitute it with black man. And I want you to just relax. It's about 1,200 words, and it'll take about 5 minutes or so. And I'm going to read it in that mid-Southern accent. So the way my grandparents talked, and how I think Huck is supposed to sound, okay? I went to the raft and sat down in the wigwam to think, but I couldn't come to nothing. I thought till I wore my head sore, but I couldn't see no way out of the trouble. After all this long journey, and after all we'd done for them scoundrels, here it was all come to nothing. Everything all busted up and ruined, because they could have the heart to serve Jim such a trick as that, and make him a slave again all his life, and amongst strangers too, for 40 dirty dollars. Once I said to myself I would be 1,000 times better for Jim to be a slave at home where his family was, as long as he got to be a slave. And so I'd better write a letter to Tom Sawyer and tell him to tell Miss Watson where he was. But soon I give up that notion for two things. She'd be mad and disgusted at his rascality and ungratefulness for leaving her. And so she'd sell him straight down the river again. And if she didn't, everybody naturally despises an ungrateful black man. And they'd make Jim feel it all the time, so he'd feel ornery and disgraced. And then think of me. It would get all around that Huck Finn helped a black man get his freedom. And if I was ever to see anybody from that town again, I'd be ready to get down and lick his boots for shame. That's just the way of it. A person does a low-down thing, and then he don't want to take no consequences of it. Thinks as long as he can hide, it ain't no disgrace. That was my fix exactly. The more I studied about this, the more my conscience went to grinding me, and the more wicked and low-down and ornery I got to feeling. And at last, when it hit me all of a sudden, that here was the plain hand of Providence slapping me in the face and letting me know my wickedness was being watched all the time from up there in heaven, whilst I was stealing a poor old woman's black man that ain't ever done me no harm, and now is showing me there's one that's always on the lookout and ain't gonna allow no such miserable doings to go only just so fur and no further. I most dropped in my tracks, I was so scared. Well, I tried the best I could to kinder up, soften it somehow for myself by saying I was brung up wicked. And so I weren't much to blame, but something inside of me kept saying, there was the Sunday school, you could have gone to it. And if you'd have done that, they'd have learned you that people that acts as I'd been acting about that black man goes to everlasting fire. It made me shiver. And I about made my mind up to pray and see if I couldn't try to quit being the kind of boy I was and try to be better. So I kneeled down, but the words wouldn't come. Why wouldn't they? it weren't no use to try and hide it from him, nor from me neither. I knowed very well why they wouldn't come. It was because my heart weren't right. It was because I weren't square. It was because I was playing double. I was letting go to give up a sin, but it away inside of me, I was holding on to the biggest one of all. I was trying to make my mouth say I would do the right thing and the clean thing and go to write to that black man's owner and tell where he was. But deep down in me, I knowed it was a lie, and he knowed it. You can't pray a lie. I found that out. So I was full of trouble, full as could be, and I didn't know what to do. At last, I had an idea, and I says, I'll go and write the letter, and then I'll see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing the way I felt as light as a feather right straight off, and all my troubles were gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway black man Jim is down here 2 miles below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him, and he will give him up for the reward if you send Huck Finn. I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I ever felt so in my life, and I knowed that I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And I went on thinking, and I got to thinking over and over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms. And we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him again in the swamp, up there where the feud was and such like times, and he would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard and how he was so grateful and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied it a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right, then, I'll go to hell. And I tore it up. It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said. And I let them stay said and never thought no more about reforming. I shoved the whole thing out of my head and said that I wouldn't take up wickedness again, which was in my line being brung up in it, and the other weren't. And for starter, I would go to work and steal Jim out of slavery again. And if I could think up anything worse, I would do that too. Because as long as I was in and in for good, I might as well go whole hog. A lot of people think of Mark Twain as that cocky old man with the sort of the gleam in his eye, the really cantankerous old guy. But he wrote this when he was in his mid-40s. And it says something about heart. And after he wrote this section, he shoved Huckleberry Finn in the drawer for 4 or 5 years. It sat there while he wrote Life on the Mississippi. And then when he finished it, most people look at the ending as though he sort of bailed out of this. He bailed out of what I just read you, which is one of the most I think he's one of the greatest moralists of the modern age. I think he said something about universal human values, about siblingship. There's the old Suzuki Roshi talked about, I've got it here. This is from No Trace, from Zen Mind. When we become old, we are often proud of what we've done. When others listen to someone proudly telling something which he has done, they will feel funny because they know his recollection is one-sided. They know that what he has told them is not exactly what he did. Moreover, if he is proud of what he did, that pride will create some problem for him. Repeating his recollections in this way, his personality will be twisted more and more until he becomes quite a disagreeable, stubborn fellow. And this is an example of leaving a trace of one's thinking. We shouldn't forget what we did, but it should be without an extra trace. Well, he remembered a lot, and he came a long way. He was born in 1835, and he lived in the antebellum South, the pre-emancipation South. His uncle owned 20 slaves. He went hunting for maple syrup with them. He heard stories from them. They went hunting together for, local game like possum and raccoon. And that was what was controversial about Huck Finn. That was why from 1885, when it was published, until the mid 60s, that's why people didn't like Huckleberry Finn. It wasn't until the 1950s when the use of the N-word was considered to be objectionable. And even in the 1960s, in polite at the highest levels of public debate, it was acceptable to use that word. What people objected to was that it was read in dialect. It was written in dialect, and he would perform it in a way that was considered to be uncouth or vulgar. Vulgar, if you go back to the root of that, it just means not Latin. So there have been hundreds of years of watching human rights develop and watching language lag behind. And people that are in command of language aren't necessarily the most innovative people to express human rights. It takes folks that are willing to tell the truth. And that may be entertaining. He certainly was brilliant. He was charismatic. He was charming. I don't know what to say about that. We owe him a lot socially. He wasn't a perfect person. He carried a lot of bigotry. through his life, but he ended up in a, all in all, with a pretty good story and with a pretty good life. And so I look at that photo of Avalokiteshvara, and up in the forehead, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with the symbiology of that, but Avalokiteshvara is also canon, and the Bodhisattva of compassion, and he or she wears all of the sentient beings that need saving on her crown. She stays in the world to help those that need emancipation in the Eastern sense, not in the Western sense. And so if you look at that photo, in the front, it's a lotus bud growing up. It's not quite fully formed yet. It's a Buddha, but it's not quite blossomed yet, right? And I find that very inspiring. Also, the face is gone. There's someone who's chipped away that face, some vandal maybe centuries ago. And then the other thing that you'll typically see is, as you go further back on her head, if we could actually see the sculpture, in the back, you'd have faces that were not contented. They would be angry. They would be sad. They would be suffering, the deluded. But it means something to care about everyone and to come down to the level of anyone that you come to and be with them. And so I find him to be very inspiring for the idea that we can have a brotherhood or a siblingship that extends across the globe. And he reminds me of how recent an idea that is. So, and how hard his life would have been to be in Connecticut late in life and to hear, I mean, I read something where his community didn't want to consume maple syrup because slaves were, slave labor was used to make it. But he was aware that in the West Indies, where slavery was legal, they were just making the substitute sweetener. So that sort of like staying true to what you know and talking about where you've been, you know, I think that like in some ways, the Keokuk of my youth didn't change that much. But I think that we've changed as a country. We've moved apart. And that working, so understanding that like working class people of all races are able to relate to each other, that that is something like there's a dignity to work and there's an understanding and a respect that's conveyed when people work together, and how we could be socially estranged and not realize that we have way more in common than we think, because of relatively superficial things that we think are real. We think they are real, but they are transient. And so we have to be really curious about what the fundamental values are of our society, because we live in that society and we practice, but we aren't separate from the society that in which we live, and we have to participate in it. So we should very closely consider what are the things that we believe as a culture. And it may not be freedom, equality, and fraternity. And in Jacobin France, those things weren't necessarily, I mean, fraternity was kind of the third thing that emerged, but it could have been unity. When Napoleon took power, he eliminated equality and fraternity and put in public unity, or you know, the freedom and public unity, and those were the two values. That's a political idea, of course, but as we progress towards democratic systems, as we've moved towards rapid exchange of media, exchange of ideas that are so rich that we feel what the other person's like guts are telling us. I hope that I can convey a little bit of that with this reading tonight. And so I think I'll just open it up for questions now. And, you know, I'm interested in what you think.
Thanks, Travis. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to raise your hand or come to guest show. Dave?
Thank you very much for your talk, Travis, and especially for reminding us of that passage from Huck Finn. I imagine many of us have read it. I know I have, but it was so long ago that I've forgotten how strong particularly that passage was, and also I think it's probably fair to say that in some sense, we read that passage very differently now, more than just because we can't say the N-word anymore. Yeah. But for me, that passage really touches on something that I think is very fundamental to Buddhist practice in the West. And it's the difference basically between the view of human nature and morality that is found in Christianity and what's found in Buddhism. You know, there's this completely different view of what it means for human nature to be sort of layered over by a bunch of external constraints from society and religion and other aspects of life. I mean, in the Buddhist tradition, we say that our fundamental nature is perfect and compassionate, and that's the source of it. And that if it's overlaid with other junk, other delusions, that's the source of dukkha and suffering in the world. And Christianity sort of turns that view on its head and says, fundamentally, we are all sinners. And the only hope for us is for religion, Christianity in particular, and Jesus to layer over our true nature with all of these rules of what we can do, of what's moral and what's immoral. And so in this passage, you see Huck Finn's true nature of compassion for Jim struggling and bursting free to emerge, and all of these things that he's been taught about how not just Christianity in general, but in particular how Christianity had been distorted to support the whole notion of slavery of Black people. And the way that he's feeling so guilty because of these superimposed delusions, how much suffering this is causing him, and ultimately that the compassion in his true nature breaks free from all of that and expresses itself. So that passage just really moved me. So thank you for reminding us of that.
Thank you, Dave.
Brenda.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Brenda.
Yeah. Lovely talk, Travis. I think, one of the things that, we've been mulling over and that's kind of coming to mind too, and some of the things that we've been hearing about sort of ancient Chinese Zen, is that keeps coming to my mind is that one of the reasons that the ancient Zen masters were so successful in having Zen live on in China and then in Japan is welding it to the culture, welding it, making it live in the culture. And I think that's one of the things that we're still in the process of trying to do is, as Dave always reminds us, the first 100 years are the toughest. And I think, this is a very important step in this direction, what you kind of charted out tonight. So thank you.
Thanks, Brenda.
Great talk, Travis, and thank you for that passage. I don't have my question fully formulated, but there's something I want to talk about that I noticed that was a parallel both in Huck Finn and with Avalokiteshvara and the picture side by side. So the story of Huck Finn, Dave pretty much captured it, but Huck Finn is basically accepting that he's going to go to hell for all of eternity, but he can't turn his back on Jim. And it's showing in a way that society tends to, or at least in that time, really retaliated against people for helping out, people who were enslaved. And then I looked at the picture that you shared of Avalokiteshvara, and you said on her crown is all of the people, all of the souls, that all of the beings that need to reach enlightenment, and how she's holding them with such love and such compassion. And then someone went and just defaced her, they just scratched off her face. And if you know the story of canon, she actually, I think, did suffer some kind of, attack or disfiguration or something happened to her body. So I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts and on that kind of, someone who's not in the most vulnerable position, but they have compassion for the person in the vulnerable position, and in a sense they end up taking some of the hit. Are we going to grow out of that? Is that
so thank you for your question. Great question. I was thinking I was going to talk about equality, and I think that's more of a difficult, abstract idea, at least for me. Who does that? How do we do that? Now, we should work our butts off to lessen inequality as a society. And aspirationally, to be a sibling to someone, to be really close to people and to work with them is the way we do that. So that's why I skipped by that French value. I skipped by it because I think we've also moved by it culturally. And where we really have potential is by building communities of people that that want to be intimate with each other, that want to share themselves and want to help. Helping people at some point, you've got what you want, and you know, just to feel a little less alone. And, you know, I think none of us is an exemplar. And either, you know, either of those portraits I showed really just points for me, it just points to a direction I want to go. But it's in the end, I have to go beyond that. And we all do. Concepts of someone else doing the being the bodhisattva that we are already.
Thank you. Vanessa?
So I'm drawing these like lines in my mind about between a lot of the things that you've talked about, and particularly I'm really liking this kind of connection between like thinking about the rise of the novel as a literary form and thinking about it in the context of fraternity or siblingship, which I think is a fantastic word, and compassion. And, you know, and vulgarity too. And I sort of feel that, like, you know, the intersection of these four things is really interesting. I mean, the way that the form of the novel has sort of fought for vulgarity in a way, you know, has kind of fought against elitism, the way that the novel sort of is like a study in intimacy, and it's precisely a study in people, like coming from this this kind of point of view of siblingship. I mean, the novelist, you know, essentially really wants to erase themselves and put their characters at the forefront, you know, like it's really about this. And then sort of thinking how easily that can spill over into entertainment. And how easily it can spill over into that kind of perhaps more contemporary nuance of vulgarity, like when we talk about something being vulgar these days, you know, or in common speech, like we don't necessarily mean it's something referring to the common population at large, but it's something that's sort of perhaps rude or inappropriate. So it's a sort of, I feel like there's this sort of perpetual struggle between a kind of more elitist faction trying to lay claim to the novel as high literature, and you know, and it really being the realm of siblingship, of fraternity, of some kind of like equality. And I'm just wondering if there's anybody like since Mark Twain or any kind of work that you see from any sort of artist, whether they're novelists or they use another art form today that's performing that same kind of function that Mark Twain did, doing that same similar kind of work.
Good question. Thanks. Well, I look at Mark Twain sometimes with his contemporaries. So he's been compared, or he's been talked about with respect to Horatio Alger quite a bit. And Horatio Alger, you know, is known for that sort of rags to riches story, you know. And it's a consistent theme. And he was a popular writer, and he just kept writing those types of books. And that was part of the ethos in which Twain lived. I think he had an additional depth because he had seen parts of America that were much different than, as you say, the elites of the time had ever experienced. And you know, the other author that I think about with relation to Mark Twain and other contemporaries, Leo Tolstoy, the Russian writer. And he was born and he died, you know, roughly the same time. And a lot of progressive thought today, you know, you can kind of go back to Tolstoy. But interestingly, with Tolstoy, he was sort of pre-spiritualism. So he was an ardent Christian. I don't want to like actually explain it like just so. Like he was in the 19th century, so he took a literalist interpretation of moral Christianity. That's a very simplistic thing. You should read him yourself. But you know, he really took to heart like the things. By the 19th century, people kind of had an idea. There was a lot of biblical scholarship, and they had an idea of like, these are kind of the things that Jesus might have actually said. We should take those really seriously. Well, it's the Sermon on the Mount stuff. If I think about, that's the, you know, turning the other cheek. Blessed are the meek. If someone strikes you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. If someone takes away your cloak, you know, give them your tunic also. Just really like that really radical Christianity that was around back then. And there were people that were really serious about living that way. So that's how I think about Twain. I put him on that level with Tolstoy, as being ahead of Alger, but a contemporary. So he's informed by the America of Alger, but he has the moral depth of Tolstoy. And most of 20th century geopolitics is like the intellect of Tolstoy and Twain kind of like arm wrestling, if that makes sense. That's how I think about Twain's legacy and how, what the impact was of his writing.
Hi, Travis. This is Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for being here. I know it's early.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your talk. You know, it's interesting that your talk is happening just weeks after the 4th of July, when the U.S. celebrates the myth of freedom and equality in the country. And, you know, I noticed that usually there is a lot of celebration when the 4th of July happens. But this year, it was a very different feeling, you know. A lot of people are reflecting on that. And I think a lot of the things that happened lately show that, you know, that is not true, that we are so far away from that in the U.S. So I wonder what are your thoughts on that?
I have some idealism. I believe in people. I like people. I believe in how we can come together if we see the commonality in each other. And so that's sometimes hard to just bundle it all into a holiday. You know, what do we do the other 364 days? That's where the practice comes in. And that's where I talk about values, but this is all coming from our universal self. And you're in Spain and I'm here. But we're not so different, and you know, that's a real blessing that we can be together. Thank you.
Any other questions? Vanessa?
I only have a second question if nobody else has one right now. Lots of questions. Actually, this is more kind of historical stroke factual, but as someone, you know, who is not very well acquainted, I'm learning about US history as fast as I can. But could you tell me a little more about why is it, you mentioned about the highest crime statistics being in the cities along the, is it the Mississippi River, you said?
Sure, yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about why that is?
Yeah, of course. So it's a highway. That's the short answer. It wasn't a highway really in Twain's time. It was an adventure. And he had that romance to it. And then later in life, when he went back, he already saw that it had changed. But he lived in a time of abundance. The nature was, it was so beautiful. The Mississippi Valley, so beautiful. You know, the cypress trees that you were photoing in Florida, you know, you would go to the Delta in New Orleans and you could just paddle out for miles and see them all over. Mm. You've heard of John Deere, the tractor company?
Yeah.
So the plains back then, were still there. John Deere was a blacksmith in Western Illinois, and he patented or made the first high quality steel plow that could break the plain. So if you drive through the Midwest now, you see field after field of corn and soybean, and that's made to maximize economy of diet, right? It's not really for the environment. And a lot of what flourished, because the town I grew up in was large in the Gilded Age, 1870, 1880, that time period. But it was always a wild place. You know, that Appalachian influence, along with the way that the river became people tried to control that river and control the middle part of the continent, it's not a place where I don't think there's a lot of understanding culturally from coastal folks as to what the Midwest is really like. Like I could drive 4 hours to Chicago, but culturally it's so different. You know, culturally, you know, if I go to St. Louis, I understand people as a child. This is my own experience. And then I felt like I needed to talk about the Mississippi Valley because of George Floyd, because Minneapolis is part of the Mississippi Valley too. And I lived in Minneapolis as well. So, you know, when you next time you look at a US map, like look down the Mississippi from Minneapolis to New Orleans, just trace your finger down. And you can just see how like there's this stripe of commerce, of diversity. Like the town I grew up in is, you know, ethnically more consistent with America in general than the Bay Area or Calaveras. It's a little bit of a microcosm of that. And people have had to get along with each other and deal with the worst parts of American history together for a couple hundred years now.
I just want to thank you for that question, because the dots are now connecting in my head. We used to talk about war in the Middle East, and the reason we have so much war in the Middle East for as long back as we can remember, is it's the major cross section of all these trade routes and all these different
right.
together. But I never made that connection to the Mississippi River, as this is a major freeway of commerce, and where there's resources and trade routes, that's where money is, and that's where conflict happens, and that's where
right. And economic strain. Yeah. So you would have periods of boom and bust. Most of the lynchings in the Jim Crow era, from like 1880 to 1950, happened in the Mid South. People think it was in the Deep South. It wasn't. The Tuskegee Institute, I think the estimate is there were between 4,000 and 5,000 people that were lynched in that era. 1,300 were white people, and a lot of these were European immigrants, like Germans and Finns and people who didn't speak the language and would come into these communities and disrupt everything. And so it was a failed state, really, it was the Reconstruction. People took extrajudicial action against their fellow citizens because they felt like they had no faith in the government and they were under attack. So, if you're going to talk about the Middle East, and we in our lifetimes got a lot of that news cycle about terrorism, that was a form of racial terrorism. That was grassroots. It was regional. And it's back to what I was saying about media. When you have a certain level of media, there was a period like around the turn of the night, from the 19th to the 20th century, where people would attend lynchings, and this was a mob of thousands of people in some cases. And they would print out like postcards and send them to their friends, right? And then you think about like the 30s, the 40s, when there was more awareness and there was video and people knew where people were. And there was less ability for people to go out and exact this kind of viciousness on their fellow Americans. I just can't really say it any better than that, but I just want to say, that continues to influence me. But what I said earlier about literature is that I think it would be overwhelming if I didn't have other voices, if I didn't have other people who had a similar perspective or a broader perspective. And, whether that's a friend or, a writer, I benefit from thinking about not only the sort of brutal mechanics of what happened, but what that does to a person's heart and how you can take that and grow from it and actually and transcend it in a way. If it helps people to hear about this, I hope that's kind of what I wanted to get across tonight. It's not a new problem, is what I'm saying.
No. Travis, I have another question. You said, I think at the beginning you mentioned something about what it means to be a Buddhist in the modern times, right?
Yeah.
So what does it mean?
Well, we take the precepts when we become a student, and and those are not to kill, not to steal, and you get down to like 7 or 8, you know, not to extol others, not to extol yourself or slander others, and I think that we do our best, and I can't really know if I try to be a Buddhist. I try my best. I have to live in the world. I try to compete with either images I have of myself or with other people, because I find that humanity is really the best show going. You know, I went camping last week, and I was up in the Sierra, and I was up in places where, you know, where it's still untouched. It's still completely natural, and perfect lakes and streams and granite, clean air. And that's the kind of Buddhist I want to be. Even if I live in the world, I think that it's good to be out in nature and to disconnect. Even though, you know, we do things like Zoom, and you know, I guess maybe Christianity in a way came on a literate cusp. And I think Buddhism, I know less about the early development of Buddhism. But I kind of look at like the way we have to maneuver in the digital world now, the networked age, as being a pretty dramatic change. Like there's a sort of linear, it feels sort of linear for a while, and now we're in a phase where it doesn't feel linear, and it feels like it's accelerating. And we have to keep enough we have to be strong in our practice, I think. That's what I think of when I think of modernity and Buddhism.
Thank you, Travis. So we're after 9 o'clock. If anyone else has a burning question, we could take one more. Otherwise, we will close out and continue afterwards. Les, are you trying to say something? Peter?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Travis. It's really thought-provoking and just wonderfully eloquent talk about Mark Twain. There's something percolating in the back of my mind, which is this maybe a like a really strongly felt contrast. I grew up where you are right now, up in the Sierra Nevadas, in Arnold and Murphy's, in Calaveras County, the place where that Mark Twain wrote about in the great Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. And growing up there always felt like there was this missed connection between Mark Twain and the culture of the area. In the kind of like the county seat, Angels Camp, there's a park that has a big old statue of Mark Twain, and we have schools named after Mark Twain, and every year at the county fair we have a frog jumping competition where everyone gets together and sees how far their frog will jump, and whoever's frog jumps the furthest, gets a star in concrete in the on the town sidewalk. And you can go and you can look back and see all the records of all the frogs. And it's there's almost this obsession with Mark Twain. And so as I was growing up there, I was kind of steeped in Mark Twain and stories. And they're wonderful. They're wonderful, wonderful stories. And so many of them are about that area and the gold rush times and everything that was going on. And the kind of wonderful morality of his perspectives always kind of really, really came through quite strongly. But there was such a contrast for me growing up there where, and I feel like a sense of shame like saying this, but on honest reflection, I did not know that the N-word was a bad word until I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. I think I knew of like one Black person in the county. And that was because my dad was close personal friends with the white family who had adopted them. And there was just such a profound contrast between the morality of that kind of breathes through Mark Twain's writings and the culture of the county that kind of celebrated him, but maybe celebrated his celebrity, maybe celebrated like the form of some of the things that he wrote about, of kind of anchoring on the frog jumping. I like what you were talking about how I see a parallel. I think you and I had very different childhoods. But just in the similar way of you were explaining how your town is something of a story of the United States, kind of a story of the conflicts written on your town's history. Maybe there's a similar story of kind of a missed message of the morality of Mark Twain. I don't know if I have a question, but it strikes me as I'm hopeful. I feel a hopefulness that maybe this moment right now in American history is a chance to actually confront questions of racial justice. I haven't been home in some time, but I'm hopeful that there are conversations happening up there right now because of George Floyd and all of the protests. I'm not sure this is a question, but I'd be very curious if you have thoughts about any of this.
I do. I think there's really like a element of patriotism that is sort of superficial, that we can get through on our own. Nobody can do that work for us. To be American and to work towards a better society doesn't mean we need to think less globally. I do think in the universal human values, and that's why I chose the French democratic values. But you know, I could just as easily go into the I Have a Dream speech and pull out these three words. And so to be a good American means sometimes to give skillful criticism of America. In my last talk on freedom, I quoted Teddy Roosevelt. Guess who was the greatest critic of Teddy Roosevelt? Mark Twain. He said amazing things near the end of his life about what U.S. foreign policy should be, including the invasion of the Philippines. So just check that out. He was he called Roosevelt a bully, and he Roosevelt said, Americans can criticize me whenever they please. That's your right. That was just over 100 years ago. So I think we can get back to that, especially if people, and most people are working class, right? So if most people can sort of see the that they're part of a community and that we're all together in this. Thanks, Peter.
Well, with that, I think we will close for the night, but you're welcome to stay on longer after we finish if you want to continue discussing. So thank you, Travis, for a wonderful talk.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.